Good morning. Good morning. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So last time we talked a bit about mostly inheritance in C++. And we talked about some issues that didn't come up when we dealt with inheritance in Java. So one was we know that we turn C++ into assembly. So somehow we have to actually have assembly code generated to convert between a base class and a subclass and vice versa, to use pointers to a base class that actually points to a subclass and so on. And we learned the most important strategy for that, which is that we laid out our object with the base class first and the subclass after that. And then in the simple cases for inheritance, we could just use the pointer we had to the subclass as if it were a pointer to the base class, because the first part was the base class stuff. We also learned about dynamic dispatch. So in C++, we have this weird default that if you have inheritance and you override a method, we don't actually use the override method unless you're calling it on something with the subclass's type. So you have a pointer to the base class, which really points to the subclass object. By default, C++ generates a call to the base class methods. And we learned that the way to avoid that was to use the virtual keyword. And the implementation technique for that was this thing we called vtables, that we'd add this hidden field to the object, which would point to a table of the methods. So at runtime, when we had a pointer to the base class, we'd look up in this vtable what the methods actually were, and that would be set based on the actual type of the object, and it would be set correctly because we called the subclass's constructor, which wrote that hidden field of the object for us. We also talked about multiple inheritance. So in Java, you had simple multiple inheritance with just interfaces, where you could specify some methods, and somehow that would be worked out. In C++, we have a more general form of multiple inheritance, where we cannot just say, I want to have something which I say implements these particular methods. I can have method implementations and member variables and so on. And that makes things a lot more complicated. So we have one issue, which is how do we represent that object layout? So if we have our multiple objects inside one multiple base classes inside one object, we can't use that trick of just saying, I have a pointer to the subclass, I just use the same thing to point to the base class and it works, because we have to change what happens for different base classes. And the simple solution for that is that casting a pointer from the subclass to the base class is not actually a no operation, like we've been used to converting between pointer types being. It actually takes into account where is this base class in this subclass. And if it's not at the beginning, it adjusts where the pointer points. Yes?
Do they show up in the order you list them when you start them all?
So the question is, do they show up in the order you list them?
Yeah, like in memory. Are they in order according to how you list them?
The question is, yeah, are they in order? I believe so. The place to look it up is that C++ ABI document I showed a screenshot of, which is where that decision would be made. This is not something the C++ standard mandates anything about the layout. Like, you could imagine a C++ implementation where, like, everything is hash tables by name, even though that would be really inefficient. But I believe typically everything's based on the order you declare things in pretty much all implementations. And we learned about another very special problem with multiple inheritance, which was whether we would have shared or duplicated base classes. And this comes up because, unlike with interfaces in Java, well, it doesn't really make a difference, if you have two copies of comparable or one, as long as the overridden methods always look up, the compare to in the most subclass. But when we have like a pointer, like I say, a next and a previous pointer, well, then it matters. Do you get the ones for one copy or the other, or is there just one? And C++, being infinitely flexible, supports both of these patterns. It supports shared inheritance, where if we have two classes that inherit from person and we make a subclass of both of them, we could have one copy of the person class. Or if we have two classes which inherit from the make me a list node class, we can have two copies of the list node class, one for each of those superclasses. And the shared case requires us to do some special work. The non-shared case is just effectively we have, you know, in the object somewhere, we have two copies of the value. In the shared case, we're going to need to figure out, well, you know, if I have a pointer to one of the base classes, how do I find that shared object, which is clearly, you know, has to be in a different place than it typically is for something which is a subclass of two base classes. And remember that something we have to do is that shared inheritance use this virtual keyword, which is a hint for the implementation. Everything we have marked with the virtual keyword, we're going to implement using this vtable. And that's how we implement the shared inheritance, is we use the virtual table to find where is this base class, because it changes depending on how many times it's been inherited. And so we learned that if you look at the case where we have this duplicate layout, where we have, you know, some get next prof and get next student, and these use the list node base classes, that when we're converting to the list node of the appropriate type, we actually look in different parts of the object. Versus for our shared person class, somehow, no matter which type we go through, we need to get the same thing. And because we know that, you know, the student and professor class, when we declared them, we didn't know there was a student professor subclass, it has to be the case that we find out where this common person fields are, where, like, where the person's name field is in the object has to be figured out dynamically. So we have to have some indirection to implement that. And following C++'s policy that they don't do any indirection unless you tell it, you have to use the virtual keyword to ask for this indirection. So one possible thing that we could do to lay this out is we could say have, this could be the layout of our student professor object. That we could have, we would need to have vtable pointers for the student and professor classes, both because they probably have methods we're overriding, that we need to specify where do I find the implementation for that, and because we need to have in there how do we find the person object. So we're assuming here that, like, this, in this hypothetical example, this distance is about 48 and this distance is about 32 bytes, and we use that offset in the vtable when we want to convert to a person type. And because we have that offset, you know, I can add more subclasses here between where I put the person object, and everything will still work out. And each of these vtables we have set to point to a vtable which has the methods for student professor, because this is really a student professor object, no matter whether we're viewing it as a student object or a professor object or a person object. They're all student professor objects, so they're all going to use the student professor versions of the method. And so that means, for example, when we convert our student professor pointer to the various types, we'll get pointers to parts of the middle of this object, but it will work out that, you know, those will act like our student professor class. And one detail I'm glossing over here is that if you think of this print method here, it's going to be called with a pointer to a person. And we not really know it's a student professor method, When we implement that print method, the compiler is going to probably do some extra work and maybe have two versions of the method, one which expects a pointer to here and one which expects a pointer to here, and the second version just adjusts the pointer and calls the other one, probably. Yes?
Okay. So if we have a grandparent class, right?
Yeah.
With a method that's called a method A.
Yeah.
Right. And we've got two parent classes, both of which inherit from the grandparent class, and both of which override method A to do something different in the two different classes.
Yeah.
And then we've got a child that inherits from the two parents but doesn't inherit from the grandparent except indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to call method A on the child.
So the question is, let's say there was no student-professor print, but there was a professor print and a student print in this example. And we assume there's a person print too. So what happens if we have print? I don't actually know the exact answer. I think it's an error.
Okay, because I tried to do it in...
Or if not, like, there's probably a single choice that is made about which print is called, and it's probably not the one you want. Like, the rule of thumb is if you have that sort of ambiguity, you should choose. And, like, even if you only want to call, say, professor print, you'd write something like void student prof print. And you'd use the syntax we showed you earlier to just call professor print. So you can use the syntax here to access to in student professor, you can use the syntax there in any of your methods to explicitly access a particular parent's thing. As someone just using the class, I don't think you're supposed to be able to directly choose the method you access, but in implementing student professor, you can definitely, even if it's not in the print method, you can still call a chosen superclasses methods.
Once we're in the main method, if we haven't done that, is there a way to choose the superclass other than making a pointer of the superclass type?
So the question is there a way to choose a superclass other than making a pointer the superclass type, choose the superclass method? So in the case where you have like these conflicting print methods, I'm not even sure if that works.
Okay.
Because like it's the vtable, right? The question is what is the vtable entry for print set to? In all these vtables. And probably it's in the person vtable because it's a person method, but like, and that's gonna probably just be one thing. So I'm not sure there's a way, but I don't actually know, like you might be able to just call it explicitly with this type of syntax. I just don't know whether that's allowed or not, because generally you don't want to do it. Right, this is kind of breaking our abstraction of our class. We don't want our class to like show the things it's inherited from directly. We want to just call methods on it.
So if we have conflicting parent classes, like the same method in different ways, then we're gonna need to handle that in our implementation of the child class. We can't handle that later in the method.
Question is, yeah, if you have conflicting parent classes, you need to handle that in your child class. Yeah, so I'm not actually sure whether, strictly speaking, you need to handle it there, but definitely that's the always recommended style. Just because it breaks sort of our notion of what an object would do. And I'll get to, I guess, some style issues briefly later. Okay. So, with this note on our class layout. Any other questions about how we implement this multiple inheritance idea here? Okay. So, one other thing to talk about is something with inheritance that happens in Java that we don't do in C++. And in Java has what is commonly called covariant arrays. So in Java, you can take an array of strings, this is okay, this is error. You can take an array of strings and you can convert it to an array of objects. And this gets used all over the place in like complex Java programs. And if you later on I should write, sorry, A as objects. That's obviously later on, if you try to assign an integer to that array of strings, you're going to get a runtime error. So Java is doing this runtime type checking, but allows you to convert this. And that's because, well, you don't really have an array of objects, but Java kind of lets you pretend. And if you, maybe if you learned about object-oriented design, and you learned about like the substitution principle, you learned that, oh, right, this string array can't really substitute for this object array because they aren't actually substitutes for each other. Like, they have different functionality as far as the set method. If you only cared about the get operation, then yes, they substitute for each other, but that's not an array type Java has. Java doesn't have a read-only array type. And C++ just doesn't do this by design. So, in C++, if you have a point array of pointers to some child type, we learn that you can convert each pointer to a pointer to the parent type. You cannot treat that that vector here as a vector of the other type. That will not compile. It's not an allowed operation. And I believe, so this is making a reference that points to the same vector. But I believe also copying it usually wouldn't work. I guess maybe it would. And that would be a separate object in which you can modify and put other subclasses in. So C++ just doesn't allow this, and that's by design. Okay. So we talked a bunch about multiple inheritance and sort of all the tricky corner cases. And one thing about multiple inheritance in C++ is that's probably one of the least liked features of C++. So, for example, if you read the Google C++ style guide, it says, only very rarely is multiple implementation inheritance actually useful. We allow multiple inheritance only when at most one of the base classes has an implementation. All other base classes must be pure interface classes tagged with the interface. So by has an implementation, they mean all the methods. So in the case where there's no implementation, all the methods are pure virtual. They're equal zero abstract. That is the rule that Google has made for people in Google writing C++ code. Is that they only use multiple inheritance the way it's used in Java to make interfaces. Another example is the Joint Strike Fighter has a C++ style guide. Part of it says stateful virtual bases, so that diamond inheritance pattern that we could implement should be rarely used and only after other design options have been carefully weighted. So by stateful virtual bases, they mean virtual base classes which aren't just all methods, which have any instance variables whatsoever. So they're okay with interfaces, so that's something that people commonly like, but generally for multiple inheritance, people do not like having these diamond inheritance of implementations. I guess another thing about inheritance, which I should just allude to, is you remember I told you that we have public because there's something where if you put, say, private or protected there, it means a different kind of inheritance. So that's something, not surprisingly, called private or protected inheritance. And that's usually also frowned upon by style guides, but people differ on that. Thing that people giving style advice for C++ will say is to prefer composition to inheritance. So C++ has these various extra types of inheritance we haven't even talked about, as sort of a replacement for having composition So private inheritance means you are a subclass, but you hide all the parents' methods from people who are using you. And many people say that, well, that's a nice idea, maybe, but isn't it clearer if you just write that as I have that, what I would have as the superclass as a member of my class? If that's what I want to do, if I want to inherit from something but not expose any of its methods to anyone else. Just want to wrap them and do my own thing. But you could imagine that as a way of like implementing a stack in terms of a vector. You could inherit from a vector class and do that privately. But people usually say that that's a bad design. But opinions vary. As with all style guide things, you can always find a style guide which will say the exact opposite. So there's one more C++ issue I'd like to talk about, but before that, any questions on inheritance or class layout in C++? With the note that next week's lab kind of touches on this topic. Okay. So the other C++ thing I'd like to talk about is that, well, there are more recent versions of C++, and some of those features are interesting and things you probably should know about, you know, just at a very high level if you're going to code C++ in the future. I'm going to try to focus on some of the ones which are probably either more useful or more frequently come up. So C++ has had a whole lot of versions. So we have C++ 98, 2003, 2011, 2014, 2017, and apparently there's going to be a new one in 2020 is the thought. You can tell how slow the process is by the thought that they just that's their best estimate on the date. And the version that comes out in 2020, I think, well, might have used to been called CXX1Y. Because they thought it would come out in this decade, but I don't think so. But all these versions, and they've added some really huge features that dramatically change what typical C++ code might look like. And these features are either things which were like completely new with the standard, or where there was some popular library. Most notably, there's a set of libraries called Boost, a lot of which has sort of migrated into the C++ standard library in more recent versions. So, start by talking about today most of the core language features which are changes. So, we talk about something called move constructors and a related concept of something we call the R-value reference. Which, yes, sounds very intimidating. And some simpler things like initialization with braces instead of parentheses, for each loops, type inference, putting the return type at the end of a function, null pointer, and something called smart pointers. Okay, so I'm going to talk about move first. So the motivation for adding something called this move constructors is that if you have code like this, we have a vector of strings, we push back and get big string, this makes a copy. This calls the copy constructor for string, like we construct a temporary string object for the return value, and then we pass that to push back by reference, so we aren't making a copy yet, but when the vector puts it into the vector, it needs to make a copy of the string. You know, and that could potentially be pretty expensive. So commonly implementations have made this particular case not so bad by having the strings internally have a pointer to something and keeping account of how many pointers there are to that reference, that particular actual array of characters. But that's actually has other issues, especially with multi-threading. And with other types like, you know, this copy is a real copy. So pushback, the big thing here is it has to call the copy constructor and has to do that because, yeah, it gets a reference to an object, but it can't just assume that that object won't be changed after pushback returns, right? Conceptually, I could have been calling this where I did something like v.pushback s, and then I did s plus equals foo. And if I do that, I certainly want the text foo not to be in what I put in the vector. I don't expect that to happen. I expect the vector to conceptually make a copy of the string. But in cases like this, we'd really like to avoid that copy. And there's just not a convenient way in the old C++ language to avoid that. So C++ added this feature to allow you to move objects. So the syntax, the raw syntax, looks something like this. That we have a string 1, and we want to move it into a string 2. So we use this special standard move function. And that puts some contents in string 2. And one's contents is unspecified. And conceptually, what happens here is that that string internally, we have some class string. It has a character array inside of it, a pointer to a character array, and we just do 2.pointer equals 1.pointer. But that's only safe if we know that 1 is not going to use that pointer anymore, so we also say that, you know, 1.pointer equals null. Or something like that. But previously, we'd have to copy, do a deep copy there, or some other form of bookkeeping. And so the way this works internally, as far as like if you want to implement string and make this move possible, is that there's a special type of constructor called a move constructor, which has a very funny prototype. So here's one for a dynamic array where we're doing that thing where we copy the pointer and then set the original thing's pointer to null. And this type here, this is called an R-value reference. And it's used to implement moves. And so this move constructor just moves one object into the other and clears out the original object if necessary. For a dynamic array, it's necessary. We want to make sure if you use the original object that you don't get a crash or some weird behavior, that it just, you know, does something obviously wrong. Yeah?
Does move constructor apply to any class type?
So question is, does this apply to any class type? You can define it for any class type. And so if there isn't a move constructor and you try to do this, instead we'll call the copy constructor if you don't define one. And there's no sensible defaults. There's a default move constructor for very simple types, like your type only has int fields. But other than that, like, we'll use the copy constructor. Because that still does the correct thing, it's just slower. Yeah. So this is a different type. So this would be used like in this example, but with dynamic array replacing string. So this calls string
okay,
double
so
and.
The move instruction looks for a method that looks like that.
Yes. So it looks for, yeah, this is what the move instruction looks for. For initializing an object. And similarly, we can also assign to an object with the move constructor, with the move operation. And that looks for an operator equals, which again has that double at and ampersand type. Yeah.
So if we create our own object,
mm-hmm.
and we want to use move on it, do we need to create this?
If you want the move to do something better than the default.
What is the default?
So if you have a very simple type where, like, you don't need a special copy constructor anyways, there's a default move constructor, which does, like, basically what the copy constructor do, copy field by field, like, and that's fine. Yeah, but I mean, and yeah, it moves field by field. So if that's the right thing to do for your class, that's fine. If it's not, then you're going to need to define one, just like with a copy constructor, right? There's a default copy constructor. If copying field by field is the right thing, great. You don't need to do anything, but often it isn't. Yeah.
What's the difference between this operator and the ordinary equals operator?
So the difference between this and the ordinary equals is that in the ordinary equals, so normal equals, we'd have to do new int move from dot size, right? We make a deep full copy. And here we're not doing that. Instead, we're invalidating the thing we're moving from, which we definitely wouldn't do in an ordinary equals operator. But by doing that, we're avoiding allocating more memory to have two separate arrays.
Okay. It doesn't require any new memory,
but the cost of that is the thing we're moving from, like, is no longer useful. Uh-huh. And this is for this sort of case, right? We don't care about getBigString's return value being useful afterwards. We have no way of accessing it. Yeah.
So if we've now overridden the operator equals, is that the only one we can use? Or because it's a different type that gets passed in, can we still use the other?
So the question is, if you define these, this move constructor and this move operator equals, can you also define the others and use them? Absolutely. So as for which one gets used, so in this case, you know, in C++11, there's going to be a vector. There's a vector pushback, which takes a const t ampersand, and there's one which takes a t double ampersand. And the way the double ampersand types works is when you have something, a function like getBigString, which presumably returns just a string object, it will convert to the t double ampersand type, because we know that that's a temporary object, there's no other copies of it. And so we'll actually be moved. And this double ampersand type is called an R value reference. So R value stands for right value, as in right side of an equal sign. So it's the reference to a value we can assign from a size, the sort of mnemonic. But it specifically means something we're going to move from, which typically is either we do this explicit move operation, or it's a temporary value that the compiler knows is a temporary value and knows you can move away from. So, second features, so most of the remaining features are considerably easier to explain than the move constructor, which is indeed pretty confusing, especially since, as is typical with features C++ has added, the syntax is pretty horrible. Mostly because when C++ adds syntax, they need to make all existing programs still work, pretty much. But you can use braces to initialize objects. And notably, this fixes the issue that, you remember, you couldn't do foo parentheses. Well, you can do foo braces, and you can use braces for all the other cases. And an additional feature of this syntax is that they added support so you can initialize a vector with a list of values using this syntax. And you can write your own classes which are initialized that way. There's a special type called standard initializer list that lets you do that. But this is the very late solution to that. Why am I declaring a function in the middle of another function instead of making an object problem? So another thing, you know, stolen directly from Java, is that we have in C++ added range-based for loops, which is a great thing, you know, pretty straightforward. You can get a reference to an object, so you can change the object from this for loop, and this reference to the integer in this case, and actually change the array from the loop. So another relatively simple feature is that there's this auto keyword. So auto is technically a keyword that exists in old C++, but it's not actually very useful there. It says that the variable I'm declaring is a local variable, and it's optional. And you probably never used it because it's not very useful. You just write int x instead of auto int x. But in C++ 11, the auto keyword is used to indicate, instead of that, that figure out what type this is supposed to have for me. So in this case, I have auto it equals v.begin, which I can write instead of vector int colon colon iterator. And the compiler will figure out for me, oh, v.begin returns a vector int iterator, so that's the type it has, rather than having you type out the type. Yes? The question is this just to save typing time, or would we use this when we don't know the type? So with the things we know so far, in all cases, you could figure out the type by reading the header file. There is some corner cases involving lambdas in more recent versions of C++ where I think you can't know the type, but or the type has no name. But I don't think that comes up here. I guess, yeah, and there's also some corner cases where the type has no name for other reasons. But we don't know of any of those yet and from this class. But it definitely saves typing time, and it's particularly useful for cases like this, where, you know, if it's not vector int, but vector of vectors, like that type name gets really, really long, and you'd sure like not to type it. Related feature is that C++ now allows trailing return types, so you can write the return type at the end of a function declaration. That's another use of the auto keyword. It says the return type is later. And this is probably useful in cases where the return type is very long or something like that. Or if you just prefer this style because you like languages better, which write things this way. So another little feature is null pointer. So null pointer is a substitute for zero or null. And the most notable reason for do this is that it type checks better. If you did int x equals null, that sets x to zero. If you do int x equals null pointer, that's an error like you probably hoped it would be. So next thing we'll talk about is a feature of C++ called smart pointers. So C++ and C++ 2003, and I think 1998, had a smart pointer class, I think called auto pointer. Well, a smart pointer class, which was basically useless. But smart pointers are basically these classes which look like pointers. And recent versions of C++ have useful versions of them, mostly taken from libraries like Boost, which they've just basically copied what Boost was doing and put it in the C++ standard under the standard namespace instead of another the Boost namespace. So this external library was very popular, and they decided, yeah, we should have this all the time. And the idea of the most simple kind is that we have an object that represents a pointer. So here, unique pointer to bar is just a class which acts like a pointer. And instead of having a destructor which deletes the pointer and having something which sets the pointer and taking care of all that, we just have this pointer and that class takes care of deleting the pointer for us. But as far as accessing the pointer, we can do bar foo, you know, some method with either of these cases. And the reason that that's going to work is that the unique pointer class has operator overloading to make that work. So approximately, the unique pointer implementation looks something like this. That we have overloaded versions of operator star and operator arrow to make it act like a pointer type. So if you try to dereference it, well, it's not a pointer really, but it's going to call that operator, and it's going to get the thing, the object that it contains. But because we have, you know, this wrapper, we can define a destructor and have it be automatically deleted for us. And so I can avoid writing a destructor for foo here and just have this pointer type take care of it automatically. And I can also avoid, when I set the new value, deleting the old one. It will take care of it. Yes?
So the difference between this and a regular pointer is that this automatically uses new?
So this is not that it automatically uses new, it automatically uses delete.
Okay.
So we have there's no operator equals. Instead, we call this reset method, which automatically deletes an old value if it's not null, and it has a destructor which automatically deletes it. So we don't need to write a destructor to delete it. If we destroy this pointer, it deletes the thing it points to.
And they're called unique pointer?
Yeah, it's called unique pointer. The notion is that if you're deleting it whenever it's destroyed, it better be the only pointer to it. Or the only permanent pointer. So C++ has several of these pointer types. So unique pointer, you can think of as a pointer which owns the object. Because it's going to delete it when it goes away, like it should be, in some sense, the either the only pointer to the object or the only at least permanent pointer to the object. Like you might temporarily make a pointer and pass it to a method, but that pointer like shouldn't stay around. There's also two other pointer types called shared pointer and weak pointer. So shared pointer is for the case where we have multiple pointers to an object, and it keeps a reference count. It counts how many pointers there are, and when that count goes to zero, it deletes it for you. And as long as that count's greater than zero, it doesn't. And there's this type weak pointer, which works with shared pointers, but doesn't change the reference count. So it's like a pointer that doesn't count as a reference for the terms of deciding when do we delete the object. And this is what you use with shared pointer if you have circular references. Because if you have, you know, if you have like a pointer to a parent class, yeah, if I have two pointers to A and A also has a pointer to B, well, there's no reason to delete B ever because of this. You know, B is not going to delete A because it has a pointer to it, and A is not going to let B to be deleted because it has a pointer to it. If we use the standard share pointer thing, weak pointers are to avoid that problem. Yeah?
So regular pointers will be included in the reference count?
So the question is, regular pointers would be included in the reference count? No.
Okay.
So this is, like unique pointer, this is just code you could have written. So the reference count maintenance is just all code like this. Like there's some reset method or equals method and constructors which change a reference count that's stored somewhere. So if you use a normal pointer to the object, you don't get any of these features.
But if we have one shared pointer and we put another normal pointer, does the shared pointer's reference count go up or not?
The question is, if you have a shared pointer and you get a normal pointer, no.
Okay.
So you have to use the shared pointers to access the object, and that's why it's delete when the last shared pointer goes away, not the last pointer. So it's not that we're like making normal pointers do more things, we're just only these, if you only use these smart pointer types, you get the benefits. But when you're using normal pointers, they still behave exactly the same way. So a weak pointer is something that works with shared pointers as far as, I guess, so the difference between weak pointer and normal pointer is that it works correctly with shared pointers as far as getting a shared pointer back from the object and having the same syntax to use.
Okay.
And I believe it does some special things when the object is deleted. So I believe if the object is deleted from the shared pointers, the weak pointer will like automatically null it out. I'm not actually sure. That's a common thing to do, which is obviously helpful. Yeah.
If we had used shared pointer with our doubly linked list, would it just delete the whole thing for us?
Question, if you use shared pointer with your doubly linked list, would it delete the whole thing for us? No. And that's because you have circular references. Because like you have would always have you like deleting the head and the tail, there's still multiple references to head and tail.
What if all of our forwards were shared pointers and all of our backwards were weak?
So if all your forwards were shared and all your backwards were weak, yes, it would take care of it.
Okay.
Should you do this? Probably not, because shared pointers are not particularly cheap. Like, keeping that extra count is not that easy.
We could do unique pointers and weak pointers. Or are we not?
I think you could. I'm not actually sure that works correctly.
If you have a unique pointer to an object.
You could have normal pointers going back, probably. I'm not actually sure that works out correctly with all the linked list operations you want to do is the question, right? Because you change pointers.
But if we've just got like a regular object and we've got a unique pointer, can we
question is, if I try to take a shared pointer to something that's allocated with unique pointer, will I get an error? I believe the answer is mostly no. So I think part of the advantage of these pointer types is that if you take a unique pointer and pass it to the shared pointer constructor, you'll get an error, because that constructor doesn't exist. But if you take a raw pointer to the shared pointer, to the unique pointer object, you like turn it into a normal pointer, yes, you can make a shared pointer to that, and no, it won't behave correctly. Like, the assumption of these classes is you, like, if you're using shared and weak pointers, you only use shared and weak pointers pretty much. That's sort of the implicit assumption of all these. And if you're using unique pointers, you either only use the unique pointer or a temporary pointer you pass to a function which doesn't keep it. So, other notable features that you might see later on. So, C++ added something they call lambda expressions, which you may know from Python, which are closures, you may know that term, basically anonymous functions that use local variables. That has compile time arithmetic, like actual well-supported compile time arithmetic, and function attributes, like in Java, if you know @override, there's an equivalent to that. And compile time assertion. So all these like miscellaneous nice features you might see. And it's not the default. So you need to actually request it using options. And if you want to do this on assignments, you need to do that in your makefile.
So that is allowed though?
Up to the version our machine supports, so I wouldn't count on anything beyond C++ 11. Mm-hmm. Because of what our grading server runs. Like, at least what the lab machine supports should be what our grading server supports.
I used an 11 feature and I like did this and then I submitted it and it was like, oh, you can't use 11, right? Because it was before we did make files.
Yes, so as long as we're using your make file and it works with our compiler, which should be the same compiler that's on the lab machines, it should be fine.
Okay,
so that's what I have for today. So next time we will talk about heaps, which are a data structure to implement, you know, ordered lists where we only care about getting the least or most big thing, the smallest or biggest thing.